Chapter 18. Parachute Assassins, Saddam Hussein, and Osama bin Laden. Every day, Lou Merletti thought about how someone might try to assassinate the new president of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush. Merletti was always on the lookout for a chink in the armor of the U.S. Secret Service. The assassination of the President of the United States is, quite literally, a cataclysmic event in world history, Merletti told the Justice Department. It is also the worst possible incident that can occur on the Secret Service's watch. For this reason, it is the practice of the Secret Service to review and assess all assassination attempts wherever and whenever they occur. In reviewing gruesome assassination tapes, it was impossible for Merletti not to think about ambush scenarios he'd witnessed in Vietnam. His mind was always working to find places where presidential protection could improve, something ingrained in him by his highly motivated boss, John McGaw. One day, McGaw approached Merletti with an idea for a radical AOP, attack on principle, training exercise. Did Merletti have any trusted contacts with Delta Force, owing to his time in Special Forces? McGaw asked. Merletti said he did. John McGaw sent Lou Merletti down to Fort Bragg to meet secretly with the Delta Force commander. Delta Force, the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta, 1st SFODD, is a classified unit whose existence the Army will neither confirm nor deny. During the War on Terror, Delta's name was changed to Combat Applications Group. With counterterrorism and hostage rescue its primary missions, Delta operators are trained as a direct action strike force and are arguably the most elite of all Tier 1 U.S. military operators. Merletti presented Delta Force with a challenge direct from the Secret Service. They were to come up with the most devastating, small footprint ambush they could conceive of, to plan and train for an AOP targeting the White House. There were specific ground rules in place. The Delta operators were not allowed to use their clearances to get classified information to devise the ambush, says Merletti. They had to use recon only and use publicly available information, figure out the weak point in our defense system, and try and breach it. We told them, if we catch you in the White House tour line, it's a point for us. The Delta commander accepted the challenge and began devising an AOP operation. The chosen Delta Force unit trained for 6 to 8 weeks. Even John McGaw and Lou Merletti remained in the dark regarding the AOP that Delta Force would attempt to have a team of parachute assassins try and infiltrate the White House via high-altitude, low-opening, HALO infiltration. The operation has never been reported before. On the night of October 14, 1990, President George H.W. Bush was taken to Camp David, the presidential retreat, in Catoctin Mountain Park in Maryland. Live ammunition was collected from the Secret Service special agents on duty, an indicator that something was going on. One of the agents on duty that night, a sniper on the White House roof, recalls what happened. All of a sudden, there were these Delta guys on the lawn. It was that fast. It was a holy shit moment for everyone involved. The Delta operators did a low-level HALO pull, explains Billy Waugh. They came in free-falling at terminal velocity and pulled just a few hundred feet above the deck. This is very difficult to defend against unless you're prepared. At the time of the AOP training exercise, there was a radar system installed at National Airport, 5 miles from the White House, designed to pick up any aircraft flying in the vicinity. There was also a direct phone line from National to the White House, hardwired into the U.S. Secret Service communications office. It rang several times a week, recalls Merletti, always reporting anything that was even remotely unusual. But on the night of the AOP exercise, it didn't even ring. Delta Force outfoxed it. How the team did it remains highly classified. With this weakness in the White House defense system thus revealed, a microwave Doppler system was installed on the roof. Then, Delta conducted a second AOP training raid. This time, the Doppler raider picked up the parachute assassins. The Delta Force commander gave Lou Merletti an infrared photograph of one of the Delta operators in a harness as he was landing on the White House lawn. Merletti taped the photo to a wall in his office at the White House with the words, "No comment," written underneath. One hole had been plugged, but there was always another one to think about. The following year, in January 1991, America went to war for the first time since Vietnam. The conflict began in August 1990 when Iraqi President Saddam Hussein ordered his military forces to invade neighboring Kuwait. The United States feared that Saudi Arabia was next, that the kingdom was at risk of an Iraqi invasion. In September 1990, a meeting took place at the Riyadh Palace of Crown Prince Sultan bin Abdul Aziz, the Saudi Arabian Minister of Defense. Prince Sultan was meeting with an unusual group of visitors regarding a delicate matter that needed to be handled with the utmost sensitivity. The leader of the group was a wealthy 33-year-old Saudi national named Osama bin Laden. With bin Laden were a group of friends and colleagues, Afghan Mujahideen. This group had spent the past decade fighting Russian infantry forces following the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. It was a classic irregular warfare scenario. A much smaller rebel force, the Mujahideen, had managed to defeat one of the largest armies in the world, the Russians, using guerrilla warfare tactics. Training, weapons, and funding for the Mujahideen came from the United States, Saudi Arabia, England, Pakistan, and China. In 1989, the Russians left defeated. At the CIA, analysts called it Russia's Vietnam. Now restless and without purpose, the Mujahideen were looking for the next jihad, or holy war. It was why bin Laden was here, he told the Saudi Minister of Defense. Osama bin Laden handed Prince Sultan a 5-page proposal. The document detailed how his Mujahideen fighters would protect the kingdom from what looked like certain invasion by Saddam Hussein. The secular, hypocrite Iraqi leader must be stopped, bin Laden warned. His presence anywhere near the two Muslim holy places, Mecca and Medina, was an insult to Islam. Iraq had a powerful army, 900,000 soldiers in 63 divisions, which made it the fourth largest army in the world. Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard included some of the best-trained fighters in the Middle East. Bin Laden and the prince were both aware of the reality of the Saudi army. In 1990, it consisted of 58,000 poorly trained soldiers, largely because the kingdom relied on technology to stop an attack. Saudi Arabia owned and maintained a $50 billion air defense system supported by a fleet of British-made fighter-bomber aircraft. But as far as ground operations were concerned, the only thing between Saddam's infantry soldiers and Saudi Arabia's oil fields were a few thousand Saudi National Guard soldiers who'd been sent to the front line. According to a witness in the room named Mohammed Din Mohammed, bin Laden made a pitch for partnership. Pulling out a map, he proposed to dig a massive ditch in the desert sands along the border between Saudi Arabia and Iraq. His group of fighters would use earth-moving equipment supplied by his family's Saudi Bin Laden group. The Afghan Mujahideen would supplement the big ditch with lots of little ones using shovels, he said. In this manner, they'd create all kinds of sand traps into which Saddam Hussein's 5,700-tank armored cavalry corps would fall. I am ready to prepare 100,000 fighters with good combat capability within 3 months, Bin Laden reportedly told the prince. But the prince wasn't interested in what Bin Laden was trying to sell. He thanked him and said he appreciated the fact that his family and Bin Laden's family had always been loyal friends. But he did not need Osama bin Laden's military assistance in fighting Saddam Hussein. Bin Laden's face turned black with anger, Mohammed bin Mohammed recalled. The prince was uninterested because he already had a partner and a deal in place. Just weeks before, a $1 billion defense contract had been signed with the Americans. President George H.W. Bush's Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, met personally in Jeddah with Saudi King Fahd to secure this deal. Cheney's advisors on the trip included General Norman Schwarzkopf, Commander-in-Chief, U.S. Central Command. General Schwarzkopf would lead all coalition forces in the forthcoming Gulf War. The Americans had state-of-the-art satellite images, including ones that showed how many of Saddam Hussein's tanks were lined up on the border. Osama bin Laden had hand-drawn maps. General Schwarzkopf told King Fahd, "Tanks being deployed far forward is an indication of offensive action." It meant that Saddam Hussein appeared ready to strike. The general shared with the king the latest imagery intelligence and geospatial intelligence to make his point. The U.S. military was prepared to send fighter squadrons and U.S. troops to defend Saudi Arabia against an invasion by Iraq. All they needed was King Fahd's okay. "Okay," the king said. "We did a double take," Schwarzkopf later recalled. "So, you agree?" Defense Secretary Cheney asked. The king said, "Yes, I agree." Ambassador Charles Freeman, who was also present and who spoke Arabic, confirmed that the king had indeed given his okay. "When do you expect the first planes to arrive?" the king asked Cheney. Cheney told the king, "Within 12 hours, they'll be here." Of course, Osama bin Laden knew none of this, but he'd heard palace rumors that the Americans might be involved. It was why he was here in Prince Sultan's home. "You don't need Americans," bin Laden is said to have told Prince Sultan. "You don't need any other non-Muslim troops. We will be enough." Prince Sultan considered what bin Laden was saying. "There are no caves in Kuwait," he told him. "What will you do when Saddam Hussein lobs missiles at you with chemical and biological weapons?" "We will fight him with faith," bin Laden said. But the prince's message was clear. He was not interested in what bin Laden was selling. If bin Laden didn't yet know for certain that he'd lost the contract to the U.S. Department of Defense, he'd learn soon enough when the first of nearly 500,000 American soldiers began arriving in the kingdom, along with 1,500 international journalists who would broadcast news of the American-Saudi partnership to the world. When the war began on January 16, 1991, the Americans were already firmly planted on sacred soil. War, the president's second option after diplomacy, had not been authorized by Congress in 27 years, not since the Gulf of Tonkin resolution approving U.S. military action in Vietnam. Bin Laden was outraged. He moved to Khartoum and began plotting jihad against the United States. Within months, the CIA sent Billy Waugh there to run reconnaissance on him. Khartoum was a lawless, brutish place in 1991, ruined by decades of civil war that had engulfed the country ever since Sudan gained independence from the United Kingdom in 1956. It had been 17 years since U.S. Ambassador Cleo Knoll, U.S. Embassy Charge d'Affaires Kurt Moore, and Belgian diplomat Guy Eade were taken hostage and assassinated by Black September during the attack on the Saudi embassy in 1973. When Billy Waugh first arrived in the spring of 1991, Sudan remained a hornet's nest of terrorist activity. The president of Sudan was Brigadier General Omar Hassan al-Bashir, a warlord who took power by military coup. But the real reins of power were held by al-Bashir's secretary general, a Sorbonne-educated Islamist named Hassan al-Tarabi. Publicly, Tarabi maintained cordial relations with the United States. Privately, he was virulently anti-American. "America incarnates the devil for all Muslims in the world," he told local commanders. Through NSA Signals Intelligence, SIGINT, intercepts, the CIA learned that Tarabi was in contact with numerous high-ranking leaders of Hezbollah, Abu Nidal Organization, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and with individual terrorists, criminals, and rogues wanted by Interpol and the FBI. Tarabi offered them sanctuary in Khartoum in exchange for cash. Many took him up on his offer, and by 1991, the CIA understood these terrorists to be freely moving around Khartoum, out of reach of law enforcement and plotting the demise of the West. In April, Tarabi hosted the Arab Islamic People's Congress in an effort to unify Afghan Mujahideen and other radical players, all of whom opposed Saudi dominance. Attendees included Yasser Arafat, Ayman al-Zawahiri of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, Khalid Mashal of Hamas, and Imad Mughniya. Osama bin Laden may or may not have attended. CIA officers and counterterrorism experts differ in their opinions about when precisely bin Laden arrived in Sudan. The CIA sent Billy Waugh to Khartoum on a covert operation to conduct surveillance on these shadowy figures, many of whom maintained multiple aliases and nom de guerre to keep their identities hidden. One notable exception was bin Laden, who went by the same name he'd been given at birth. "In the very early 1990s, bin Laden was a nobody to us," recalls Waugh. "But Sudan was an anything-goes cesspool of a place. Few people had ever heard of bin Laden, who was just becoming known to Western intelligence agencies. He was on the CIA's radar, however, because he'd recently co-founded an organization called Al-Qaeda, or the Base. Bin Laden's base was made up of Afghan Mujahideen and any other foreign fighters willing to wage a holy war against the West. With the Berlin Wall down and the communist threat reduced nearly to nil, the CIA was gathering intelligence on potential threats. A political religious system rooted in early Middle Ages thinking seemed conspicuously anachronistic. Bin Laden and his Mujahideen called it global jihad. In 1989, after the Afghan war ended, the stateless Mujahideen sought an alliance with the Islamic cleric Hassan al-Turabi, who'd recently helped stage a military coup in Sudan. They were like-minded individuals. In Turabi's eyes, the failure of Arab governments was rooted in a reluctance to enforce Sharia law. Turabi became the first Muslim cleric to successfully implement Sharia across an entire nation. Bin Laden and his followers respected that. The CIA took note and began to monitor the jihadists in Khartoum. When Billy Waugh arrived in Khartoum, piles of concrete rubble lay interspersed with crumbling buildings and plywood shacks across the city. Government soldiers patrolled the streets. Armed militia manned makeshift checkpoints at the edges of town. The secret police, the Political Security Organization, PSO, arrested people at whim, mostly on grounds they'd violated Sharia law. 85% of Sudanese citizens lived without any social or civil services. Khartoum was a challenging place for an athletic, 63-year-old white man like Billy Waugh to conduct a covert operation for the CIA. Of medium height, he stood out among the majority population, Dinka tribesmen, many of whom stood over 6 feet tall. But he approached his work there the way he approached any Special Forces military operation or CIA covert action, he says. Prepare, rehearse, engage the target, and find good cover. Waugh was in Sudan as an independent contractor, or IC, for the CIA, not a full-time employee on payroll. That would be a blue badger. Rather, he was a green badger, his contracts individually written and renewed. However, the black diplomatic passport he carried, provided to him by the agency, identified him as an employee of the U.S. Department of State. In the event he was arrested by the PSO, he'd be afforded diplomatic immunity in the form of a single get-out-of-jail-free card. But getting arrested would also mean the end of his CIA career. I had a serious interest in wanting to keep my job. There was no way I was going to allow myself to get arrested. No way. One of the advantages of traveling in Sudan on a diplomatic passport, not a civilian one, was that he could use a diplomatic pouch to get camera equipment in. The government had outlawed cameras and developing supplies, Waugh says, fearing photographs would portray the desolate state of affairs inside the country and make obvious the failure of Turabi's imposition of Sharia law. People were starving to death in the streets, remembers Waugh. They'd get picked up by police and transported to areas outside the city, left to die in a less obvious place. Making photography illegal was the government's solution to this problem. How is he going to use his camera around Khartoum without getting caught by the secret police? I had an idea about how to circumvent the problem, he remembers. I suggested that I'd use jogging as a cover, start running around the city with the idea I was a stubborn old American on a fitness craze. The Khartoum chief of station said he'd think about it. He came back to Waugh with an idea that headquarters liked better. They asked me to conduct surveillance against terrorist targets wearing a disguise that made me look like a black African. The Technical Services Division created a Dinka disguise, which included a rubber face mask, arms, and hands. The concept had been dreamed up and designed by Anthony Mendez, a technical operations officer who was a legend inside the CIA for having exfiltrated 6 American diplomats from Iran during the peak of the U.S. embassy hostage crisis. In 2016, Mendez would become famous to the public as the lead character portrayed in the Hollywood film Argo. A Hollywood prop house did the mask molding and building. The problem was the mask didn't really fit, says Waugh. Its lips were too big, and in order to see through the windshield while I was driving, I had to tilt my head in such a way that my mouth was nearly touching the steering wheel. There was legitimate concern he'd draw attention to himself driving around Khartoum like that. The problems did not end there. The mask made him sweat in Sudan's oppressive heat. Summer temperatures hovered around 120 degrees Fahrenheit. The gloves that came with the mask extended from Waugh's fingertips to his shoulders, where they tied at the back with strings. The thick rubber finger sleeves made holding forbidden camera equipment dangerous and difficult. Following orders, Waugh donned the mask and drove around Khartoum in a battered, Russian-made sedan given to him courtesy of the CIA. "Like just about everything in Sudan," recalls Waugh, "my car was a wreck. It was missing a big piece of the floor, and when I drove around town, usually at 70 kilometers an hour, huge clouds of dust blew up through the open floorboards." One hot day, a new deputy chief of station, name still classified, came to town. Waugh was given the assignment of showing his new superior around Khartoum. The deputy chief wanted to be shown escape routes out of town and into the desert, roads Billy Waugh had already mastered while conducting surveillance detection routes, necessary tradecraft in the event you had to ditch a tail. During the outing, the deputy chief of station also wore a Dinka mask that had been specially designed for him, complete with gloves and arms. Waugh recalls his colleagues' deep discomfort with the lawlessness of Khartoum, heightened by the discomfort of wearing a mask. Waugh and the deputy chief set out driving. "It was hot as hell, and I drove really fast, showing him the Saharan scenery without wasting any time. He was quiet for a while, seemed miserable or at least tense. At one point he asked Waugh, 'Do you always drive this fast?' Waugh recalls making a joke. 'Yes, sir, I do,' he said. 'My passenger did not think that was very funny,' remembers Waugh. 'Where's the floor of your car?' the deputy chief asked Waugh. 'Some of it's missing,' he said. 'If the agency wants to get me a new vehicle, that'll be fine too.'" The deputy chief rode along in silence. At the edge of the town, where the city road meets the desert, Waugh's old Russian car was forced to stop by a mob of armed militia. One of the men stuck the muzzle of his AK-47 through the window. Waugh knew how to bargain with these people. He always carried cartons of cigarettes he could use for a bribe. After a bit of negotiation, the militia waved Waugh through. "I heard a muffled sound coming from my passenger, a kind of light gagging noise," he recalls. Suddenly, the whole car smelled of vomit. Waugh realized that the deputy chief of station had thrown up inside his mask. He was angry and embarrassed, but he couldn't take off the mask for fear of blowing our cover, remembers Waugh. They drove on, headed back to Khartoum. "It's your fault," the deputy chief said after a while. "The way you're driving the car caused me to throw up." The men continued on in silence. Outside, Khartoum rolled by. Waugh showed the deputy chief numerous escape routes, shortcuts into the desert, and checkpoints to avoid. Finally, they arrived back at headquarters. Once inside the building, they were met by the chief of station. By now, both men had taken off their sweaty Dinka masks. The chief of station pointed at the deputy's face and hair, which were covered in dried vomit. "What the hell happened to you?" he asked. The deputy chief was furious, recalls Waugh. He fired off a litany of angry excuses, ending with, "I can't put up with this shit." He didn't have to for long. Just a few months later, he was transferred out of Sudan. the chief of station agreed to let Wa jog around Khartoum now as a means of conducting surveillance and reconnaissance on Osama bin Laden. Billy Wa worked best alone. To be assigned a mission and to get it done by any means possible was what he was best at. Accomplishing a task that others could not accomplish made him feel alive and gave him meaning and purpose, fulfilled his boyhood dreams of feeling like he was needed in the nation's defense. Each day, he'd run an 8-mile loop around the Al Riyad section of Khartoum, employing the old-school espionage techniques of ground surveillance. His first task was to locate a decent place to set up an observation post, or OP, in agency parlance. Bin Laden's private residence was a pink, 3-story house on the old French Embassy Road. It was surrounded by high walls. Armed guards kept watch over the place, usually 6 or 8 mujahideen, dressed like they were still fighting the Afghan jihad. Visitors to his home would drive up to the compound with drapes covering the car windows, remembers Wa. He had 4 wives and more than a dozen children, but I never saw any of them. If they were there, they stayed inside. At the time, the CIA did not know much about Osama bin Laden. Wa was assigned to profile his actions so that a portrait of the man and his pattern of life could emerge. In his jogging excursions, Wa pieced together bin Laden's daily routine. The man prayed early in the morning before sunrise. At 9 a.m. sharp, he left the house, climbed into his white Mercedes sedan, license plate number 0990, and drove himself to the Arab Bank on Latif Street. For noon prayers, he would drive to another building he owned down on South Riyadh Road, where some of his staff lived. Finally, he made a trip a few blocks to the north. It was here that bin Laden's construction company, Al Hijara, owned a warehouse full of construction equipment. Through the construction company, bin Laden was building a series of new roads in a country that almost entirely lacked infrastructure. This included a road from Khartoum to Port Sudan, a distance of 520 miles. What machinery Osama bin Laden lacked, he would import from Russia through another of his companies, Al Kadurat. Often the government of Sudan was unable to pay bin Laden for his road work and construction projects, so he agreed to accept large plots of land as barter. In this way, Osama bin Laden acquired the Gash River Delta, a massive plot of land near the Ethiopian border, as well as a huge farm in Gedarif. At one point, he was rumored to be the largest landowner in Sudan. In Khartoum, Wa figured out that bin Laden owned at least 4 buildings. One of them stood near the Palestinian embassy west of his private residence. The property butted up against runway 340 at the Khartoum International Airport, giving Wa a solid viewing perspective of goods being unloaded on the tarmac. But it was while he was observing activities at bin Laden's building on South Riyadh Road that he got his first real break in the case. Directly across the street was a safe house owned by the U.S. intelligence community. This safe house, it turned out, was being used by an ultra-secret U.S. Army SIGINT unit called Intelligence Support Activity, and that went by the code name Gray Fox. Created as a Reagan-era response to the Iranian hostage rescue attempt, one of Gray Fox's primary tasks was to collect intelligence in advance of a paramilitary operation. As Wa understood it, Gray Fox was listening to activities going on in an Iranian safe house nearby. The Gray Fox facility presented itself as the perfect place for Wa to set up an observation post and take the CIA's first proprietary photographs of Osama bin Laden. One of the most important elements of warfare and of spying is the ability to look down on your target, says Waugh. In Khartoum, the general truth proved both a problem and a solution. Because it was so hot outside, many of the locals slept on the rooftops of their buildings at night. Waugh would use this activity as a cover story. He constructed a bamboo structure designed to look like a sleeping shack up on top of the roof of the Grey Fox building. He set up his camera equipment inside the sleep shack and waited. It was from here that he took what are considered to be the first CIA surveillance photographs of Osama bin Laden and his followers. They have never been released to the public, says Waugh. The photographs show bin Laden seated cross-legged and facing his followers. There were 20 or 25 of them, and they sat there mesmerized by him, listening with their mouths open. They hung on his every word. With Grey Fox as support, and while jogging around the neighborhood, Waugh was able to plant additional devices for gathering signals intelligence. But his Singleton operation came with an unforeseen threat. Osama bin Laden unleashed guard dogs. He had 6 or 8 big white desert dogs, recalls Waugh. They were meaner than snakes. They would run up to Waugh as he jogged by, threatening to sink their teeth into his bare legs. To counter the threat, Waugh began running with a lead pipe. A couple of smacks on the snout, and the dogs decided I wasn't worth the trouble, he recalls. Most of the time, Osama bin Laden's Afghan bodyguards let Waugh jog by. Sometimes they'd tail him. They followed me in a vehicle, staying about 20 feet behind me as I jogged. I ran like I was a boxer training for a fight. After a point, the guards would lose interest, get tired, or go home. Finally, he was able to get photographs from close in while jogging by the compound. Waugh left Sudan and returned months later. In February 1993, he observed the tail end of an assassination attempt against bin Laden at the mosque in Abdurrahm on the western banks of the Nile, where the Al-Qaeda leader and his followers were known to pray. A gunman leapt out of the car, sprayed the worshippers with gunfire, and sped away. 19 people inside the mosque were killed, another 15 worshippers injured. Waugh was at the Grey Fox safe house at the time. The two would-be assassins sped across the White Nile Bridge and drove all the way to bin Laden's house, more than 25 miles away, he recalls. They were never stopped by the police. From Waugh's rooftop perch on Al Riyad Street, he heard a flurry of gunfire from the direction of bin Laden's residence. Two of bin Laden's bodyguards waxed the assassin, but bin Laden escaped unharmed. So it went in Khartoum. The local papers reported the arrest of an Islamist of Libyan origin who'd fought in Afghanistan, who was tried and convicted of the crime. Was it true? Had one of bin Laden's former fighters tried to kill him? Hard to say, says Waugh. 3 months later, the man was executed. The assassination attempt got Waugh thinking. In my capacity, I was never in a position to make planning decisions, Waugh explains, but sometimes people asked what I thought was the best thing to do. So in this particular instance, I drew up a plan to kill bin Laden, he says. It was a transitional time for the CIA in Khartoum. The chief of station, codenamed Blackjack, had just left the post. An intruder had broken into his home through a window in his wife's bedroom, and in self-defense, he had shot and killed him. The story never made it to the local press, but Blackjack had had his cover blown, and he was replaced by a 43-year-old longtime veteran of the clandestine service named Kofor Black. As a teenager at the Canterbury Preparatory School in Connecticut, Kofor Black first became enamored with the concept of espionage. In an interview for this book, he remembers how he and his friends stayed up late one night trying to imagine the most exciting, most dangerous job in the world. "I came up with CIA officer," recalls Black. A decade later, when he was pursuing a PhD in international relations at the University of Southern California, he decided to leave school and join the CIA. "As a new recruit in 1975, says Black, "I was assigned the job of watch officer, monitoring foreign cables as they came in from overseas. I learned about the fall of Saigon in real time, sitting there in the operations center at CIA. It had to have been my first month on the job." The event had a profound effect on him, he says, as he watched so many evacuees clamoring to get out. "I will never forget the moment. It was total collapse. All our efforts sucked away to nil. I thought to myself, this should never happen again." Black vowed to be the most effective clandestine service officer he could be. He adapted well to Khartoum. "If you are a counter-terrorist, Khartoum was the Super Bowl," says Black. "Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, they were all there in the early 1990s. I'd been doing this kind of work for a long time. Before Sudan, I administered field operations in Angola for the CIA with mercenaries. When I arrived in Khartoum, I had operational experience." When Billy Waugh presented Kofor Black with the photographs he took of Osama bin Laden, Black was impressed by the clarity and the proximity. "Billy's never afraid of putting his personal safety in jeopardy to get the job done," explained Black. Waugh recalls being asked his opinion regarding what might be done next with Osama bin Laden. "I said we should kill him," remembers Waugh, "then take his body and throw it over the wall of the Iranian embassy. Set off a few flash grenades to draw a whole bunch of attention to the Iranians, make people show up and see what was going on." Waugh sat down, wrote up his plan, and gave it to Kofor Black to submit to the Director of Central Intelligence. There are two differing versions of what happened next, one from Kofor Black and the other from Billy Waugh. Billy's conversational remarks about UBL, Osama bin Laden, were never put to writing and never sent forward to Washington, says Black. "This was a bad idea for so many reasons I won't go further." Waugh tells a different story. "The proposal went all the way to the desk of President Clinton. I was told he read it, thought about it, and replied in a memorandum that went to the director of the CIA. The president's reply said, and I'm paraphrasing, 'We will not do this, and please do not suggest this kind of thing to me ever again.'" Waugh was a ground operator and an expert in irregular warfare. He played by many of the same rules of war as the enemy, the most important being, there are no rules. Surprise, kill, vanish. Terrorists like Osama bin Laden lived in a den of snakes, filled with rogues, assassins, and double-crossers. Waugh believes in tyrannicide, in cutting off the head of the snake. He left Sudan for another mission. This one involved teaching the 19 sons of His Royal Highness Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, founder of the United Arab Emirates, UAE, how to parachute jump. But soon, Waugh would once again return to Sudan. In 1994, Tarabi is said to have hosted another conference of rogues, albeit much smaller than the conference held in 1991. Egyptian double agent Ali Mohammed, who worked for bin Laden in Khartoum, while also double-crossing the U.S. Army Special Forces, says he personally set up this meeting, which was attended by bin Laden and Imad Mughniya. It is believed that during this meeting, Mughniya shared with bin Laden techniques for how to build truck bombs to be used in mass casualty attacks against U.S. embassies. By then, the U.S. State Department had placed Sudan on its state sponsors of terrorism list. In 1995, Osama bin Laden began planning the assassination of CIA station chief Kofor Black. The plot advanced to the point where bin Laden's fighters rehearsed the ambush on the streets of Khartoum. CIA officers determined the time and place of the assassination on a small road near the U.S. embassy. Things escalated. One day, after being aggressively tailed, a CIA paramilitary team drew guns on a group of bin Laden's men. Through the U.S. ambassador to Sudan, the CIA lodged an official complaint and warned Hassan al-Turabi against carrying out the assassination. At Langley, the CIA created a unit dedicated to gathering intelligence on Osama bin Laden. It was called Alex Station. There was a long, dangerous road ahead. Bin Laden vowed to attack the United States from the land, the sea, and the air. He would succeed on every front.